the Bounty UK podcast, episode 3. You're greeted here by me, Davey.
Alan.
I'm Simon.
And I'm Tony.
On this podcast, we're going to talk about the command line versus the GUI, MythBuntu, the production process when we make the podcast, and also a bit about the news.
Sounds good. Let's get on with it.
I don't know who said it, but there is a theory that if you're using the command line to do something in Ubuntu, it's broken because you should be able to do it with a GUI. I wonder what you thought about that.
Well, I think it's very much what you're used to. I'm very much used to using the console, even for things which you can do graphically, probably easier graphically. But because that's what I'm used to, that's what I prefer. However, if I was a new user, then I may well end up using the GUI more. And I think that for everyday users, they shouldn't have to use the GUI, but they should be aware that it's there.
Shouldn't have to use a GUI or shouldn't have to use a command line.
Sorry, shouldn't have to use a command line. And I think that they should be aware it's there and know that they might have to use it for something.
What's so scary about it? Why should someone not have familiarity with some basic commands?
The problem is they're not basic, are they? The command line is not basic. You've got to know what you're doing before you can use it.
Well, no. If you said to me, how do I upgrade the packages on my system, then I could either say, you follow this menu path system, blah, 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 or you press the orange button in the toolbar on the top of the screen, or you open a terminal and type this command. Either way, I'm conveying to you how to do it.
Sure, but it's one of the stumbling blocks. You've got to know the command before you can do the command.
Yeah, but you've got to know the menu before you can choose the menu.
So isn't the point with the menu system is that you can just explore it. You can just poke around, try the different options until you find something that you want. Whereas with a command line, you're presented with a flashing cursor. Unless you know what the commands are you're looking for, you can try to use things like apropos and man.
None of us live in a bubble. A large proportion of us have access to documentation, whether that's online. You have online help in Ubuntu, and there's help on Google and whatever. I don't know, I find it difficult when someone says, I don't know how to do anything, or I don't know what to do. They clearly have zero Google skills, or haven't even bothered trying to read a manual when they stare at a console. Or is that too harsh?
I think it is a bit harsh. We sit in the room and we ask each other. We sit on an IRC channel and we ask about things rather than spending hours and hours searching through Google or reading man or making error. I fell into the trap initially of popping into IRC and asking everybody, how do I do this? How do I do this? How do I do this? Well, and you only learn by searching yourself, of course.
To some degree, some people learn by being shown how to do something. Some people learn by actually, going off and finding it themselves.
But if somebody shows you a specific thing, then you don't learn about the theory behind it. You don't learn about shell. If you ask somebody about a specific command, you don't understand or...
But some people don't want to. Some people just want to know, how do I upgrade my packages?
Yeah.
How do I install, whatever, game? I don't care that the program dpackage does the install and it's held in /var/lib. They just really don't care. They just want it installed.
Well, going back to what you said, Simon, I actually have a different tolerance level. If someone I know is a complete newbie, I know that term's not necessarily correct, but if someone who's completely new comes in and asks a question where it will turn up in the first hit of Google, I don't mind telling the answer. But if it's anyone in this room here turn around and ask a really simple question that's obviously available in Google, I would, say, here's a Google link.
But that's because we're friends and, we can rib each other and stuff.
I don't know. I mean, people who I've known for a year in maybe the Loco channel, if they ask the same questions, I probably would do the same thing.
Well, take yesterday. I don't know if it was yesterday or the day before. I think it was the day before. We spent how long with someone in a channel trying to help that person who was clearly quite inexperienced with Linux, and we got them from, they had a server install when I think they wanted a desktop install, and they wanted to get from a server install which only has a command line, so they had no option to try GUI tools. And basically every command we told them, they just ran. They didn't really care what the effect of it was, and they don't really care what the underlying infrastructure or why in fact something was broken.
But I wouldn't be surprised that comes with time.
Yeah, totally.
Isn't part of the issue that it's easier to help people via command line than it is via the GUI? With a command line, you can paste a string into a wiki or into IRC or whatever instant messenger, and you get some text back out that you can then look at and go, yes, that's worked, or yes, that hasn't worked. Trying to describe how to do something in the GUI, click applications, add new applications, search for this string, click apply, click yes to add extra repositories. It suddenly becomes a much longer description, and then you have to get screenshots if you have a problem you want to debug, and you're hoofing bandwidth around and graphics and all sorts, so it becomes slower.
I had exactly that problem about a year ago on a Linux user group mailing list. Someone asked a question. It was something really basic, like how do I install Kausai or something like that, and I just replied sudo apt-get install Kausai, which, you know, is it's not a wrong answer, it's the right answer, and because it was an email, I was able to reply to that person with one line giving them the exact answer, and I got berated by someone else on the mailing list who shall remain nameless, because I didn't explain the graphical way of doing things, and it's the Ubuntu way to use the graphical interface, and, you know, what if I was a new user and you're telling me to use the command line? And what I think I'm getting at is I try and tailor the answer for the audience. If my brother phones up and says, how do I, you know, install some application, then I'd tell him how to go through Synaptic.
The fact that you were able to give one line which is precise and would do exactly what they wanted, maybe that is a better solution.
No, the console is scary because people have never used it before. Most people come from Windows where everything is done on the GUI. You know, I was there, what is the command line? And it was scary. And it is scary to new users.
Well, most people under the age of, what, 25, 30? Not, I wouldn't say most people come from Windows. I'd say most people under a certain age who are not of a technical background.
Okay.
Those kind of, no, I'm not trying to be picky, there are a significant chunk of people who are older than us who predate Windows and have used DOS and
Windows 95 was still heavily dependent upon DOS as well. I mean, you could get away without using it, but Windows 3.1, that was DOS.
There wasn't much command line work.
If you're not used to the commands and if you don't know the commands, they're difficult to use. I mean, when I started using Linux, I kept a big list of the commands.
So what's the fix for it? Stop telling people to use the command line, or give people more help?
No, I think we need to keep the command line. It's incredibly powerful. Sure, use the GUI, but have knowledge of the command line so you know about it when you need to or want to use it.
So should we, when we tell people how to do stuff with a graphical interface, also at the same time tell them how to do it with a command line?
Individual dependent, of course. But yeah, I think
Maybe on the forums, maybe there should be a tick box to say, I want a console answer, I want a GUI answer.
It's tricky because any of these mechanisms by which you're asking for help in a text way, like if you compare two ways of asking a question, if I'm sat next to you and you're asking me how to do something, I might show you how to do it with the GUI because we're both sat there and we can both see it. But if you're on the other end of an IRC conversation, or you're on the other end of a mailing list or a forum or any other medium which is text-based where we can't both see the same screen, it makes more sense to use the command line to tell you how to do something.
Yeah, I mean, it would be really good if there was maybe something like a screencast where you could actually watch people and actually see how to do these things graphically.
Wouldn't that be marvellous?
Oh, hang on, I think there are.
There are, yeah. There are a few screencasts that show people how to do stuff graphically, but there's a problem that comes with that. They're huge. They're much more time-consuming to create than telling someone how to type a command line. So there's a massive investment in creating a screencast. The other option, as well as screencast, because screencast is pre-recorded stuff, what about if we had a decent remote control software in Ubuntu, something not like VNC, but VNC-based, but which allowed you to, in the same way as you do with Windows, press a button to say, I need help, and, you know, allow a trusted person...
And to not worry about NAT issues or anything like that.
Yeah, for it to just work. Yeah. No matter what your network connection is like, whether it's dial-up or, you know, 3G or anything, you can press a button that says, I need help, and, you know, get someone to remotely control your screen.
I mean, I'm a command line user. I use it for administering servers, and I use it a lot on my desktop because that's the way I learned Linux. But one of the reasons that I find it difficult to just stick to GUI answers for people is not that it's often harder, which it is, but it's that the command line gives you so much power and so much flexibility. I almost feel like people who only use the desktop are kind of missing out on an aspect of the Linux desktop. If you want to do things like batch renaming files, and you can string command lines together, and I know this is not something that a new user wants to just sit down and be faced with, but once they're used to a system, once they're familiar with the desktop and can fire up applications and do all their day-to-day stuff, if they want to do system administration tasks, the possibilities are almost endless on the command line, and it's almost a shame to deprive people of that or not to help them, you know, get used to it and get into that and power and find the power and flexibility of it.
I agree, but it's very difficult because there's an infinite number of command line things you can do because it is so powerful, like you say. But shouldn't we have better front end tools. Like, for a good example you gave was batch renaming of files. Like, you get a whole load of pictures from one digital camera, photos from another digital camera, and you want to merge them, you want to move them around. And using the command line, you can do things like, you know, change en masse the names of files, or if you've got a load of documents, you can quickly change the contents of, you know, change one word in every document in, you know, with one line, do a mass search replace. And should we have better graphical front ends to those kind of tools? Or is that just, we just end up with an absolute boatload of, well, well, we'd end up with KDE, wouldn't we?
But don't you? Well, I don't think it would be installed by default, but I mean, I would have thought there would be applications out there. I've never explored that, but I would have thought there'd be applications to do that.
To do what? That specific task, battery name of files?
I mean,
I know there is one.
There are, yeah.
But what about every other possible very, very clever thing you could do with the command line? I don't think you could replace all those infinite things with an infinite number of graphical tools, because it's just such high maintenance, and it's easier for people to just type a line, you know?
It's the old, you know, Unix thing of do one task and do it very well. You can then use those as building blocks to make up some fancy thing that you might only use a couple of times. It wasn't worth writing a GUI application to do that, because you might not do it again for another year. Whereas you can put a few commands together with a few pipes, if you've got the skill to do that, and do your job well.
We could always pipe together GUI apps.
how would that work, Dave?
Oh, you know I'm being silly.
S-forces for courses, you know, it depends what you're used to. If you're used to the GUI, then you use the GUI. The command line's there, it's powerful. Learn about it and use it if you need to.
We've just got to understand that some people are happy using the GUI and don't really want to get involved in the command line. If they want help using the GUI, we've got to, you know, make sure that we can help provide help for them in that way, even if it is slightly frustrating at times, because we're more used to the command line.
We've been asked on more than one occasion how we make this podcast, what we use, and we thought it only best to let everyone know what tools we use and software and hardware, so that if anyone wants to have a go at doing this themselves, they know what might be involved. Of course, we're doing it one way. There are a million different ways to record a podcast, and this is just the way we do it.
Right, before we get into the hardware, we have to write down our ideas, and as things come up, as emails come in, as people come up with ideas, of course, we use the ubiquitous wiki. In our case, we use Moin to, you know, write down all our ideas.
And it's running on a server, a virtual server that we have for the Ubuntu UK website.
Yeah.
It's a private wiki.
But we like to keep the ideas sort of, you know, at least a bit secret, so there's a surprise and people are listening to the show.
Exactly, and if people want to get involved in helping make the podcast, we'll give them access to the wiki and all the other tools we have. It's just keeping it out of, you know, the eyes of everyone.
So that's where we put ideas. When somebody has a brilliant idea in the bath or on the way to work, whack it in the wiki. And then when we actually come up to the run-up to the show and we're actually all sitting around saying, what are we actually going to record? We use Gobby, which is the collaborative editor, and we all connect to that. And we can hash around the content, sort what order we're going to record segments in, take bits out, and add comments.
Yeah, and the content that's in Gobby comes straight out of the wiki. So the wiki is great for editing over a period of 2 weeks between one episode and the next. But then during the 4 hours that it takes us to make the one episode, we'll all sit there with Gobby open, because it's easier for multiple people to edit the same document at the same time than it is for us to all commit edits to the wiki.
The other thing we actually use is IRC. We actually collaborate quite a lot during the 2 weeks in between, actually discuss content and what we're going to do and such like that, which has been quite useful.
And also email. All the emails that come into the show go out to the four of us that are here, and Dave Murphy, who was on the last show.
Mm-hmm.
So we can all see comments that people have made and people subscribing to our Twitter feed and things like that.
So moving on to recording, how we actually record the podcast, it kind of depends, really, because some of it is recorded in what we affectionately call a studio.
Which is usually somebody's front room.
Yeah, then sometimes we record segments outside. So if we start off with the studio stuff.
I have had for years a mixer. I got a new one a few months ago, and it's a relatively simple 4-channel mixer, and it's got a few extra inputs and things. So it enables us to have 4 microphones that all plug in. So we can all hear each other via headphones. We've got a little headphone amplifier, so we can all hear what's being recorded and hear each other. And it goes out through the outputs through to a Zoom H4 recorder, which is a little solid-state recorder. Records onto SD cards in WAV format. And that's a great little device. That's what we use to record our interviews at FOSDEM, because it works independently. So it's very easy, very portable. Stick it in a pocket, stick it in a bag, and off you go.
I mean, I happen to have a couple of fairly decent microphones there, SM58 Shure microphones, but you could use pretty much anything, really.
Yeah, yeah. Again, we're kind of lucky. Alan had a couple of mics from a previous podcast idea, and I had one kicking around. But we have bought a few little bits and bobs just to help it along. Simon went out and brought a microphone and a mic stand.
So once we've got this all recorded and the master, if you like, is on that Zoom H4 device on a solid state SD card.
Yeah.
What happens next?
I take it off and I copy it onto my computer and I start chopping it around. Take out the stuff that's obviously rubbish and then listen to it again slightly more carefully and work out which bits and which segments we want to fit in. Get an idea how long they're going to run for and see what we need to fit into a 40-minute show.
That's pretty time consuming, I would think.
Yeah. I've heard both the first two shows more times than I might care to discuss.
So what do you use for the editing?
The first episode was done entirely in Audacity, so open source audio editor. The second episode I did using a mixture of Audacity and Arda. The reason for starting to use Arda is that it's non-destructive in some of its operations, so you can apply filters and make edits and cuts and things without removing the data from the file, whereas Audacity is destructive, and if you apply a filtering process or an effect and then save it, you've effectively lost the original, so you would have to go back to the very, very original sound files and fish out the bit you wanted if you decided to undo that effect. So I've tended to use Audacity for chopping the segments and chopping little pauses and things out, because it's seems to be easier for me to do that, whereas Arda's great for putting the whole episode together, applying processing and just sort of tweaking the layout and sticking the music stings in between the segments.
So you mentioned the music stings, and we've had some positive and some negative comments about the music.
Yeah.
Where did it come from?
I found it on archive.org. We talked about on IRC the sort of feeling we were looking for and the music we're after, and I was searching for sort of big band and swing and sort of, you know, early out of copyright material or Creative Commons license material that we were able to use in the podcast. I found this little piece. It was nice and cheery. So chopped it up and it had a nice kind of minute worth of intro music, which would be great before any vocals kicked in. And there's a nice little bit at the end for the outro, and people seemed to like it. And a few people said, oh, no, get rid of it.
So, Tony, when you finished cutting it about and come up with your final product, we obviously have four outputs. What do you do to produce those four files?
Okay, so I end up with a big master WAV file, and I encode it. And I was encoding the first episode quite a lot of times in different ways, trying to get the settings right. So I ended up writing a little shell script just to do the encoding with the right settings, set all the ID3 tags in the MP3, embed our little picture into the MP3 file. And by the time I'd finished, it was reasonably competent, had a little ini file and things like that. So I stuck it up on my website, which is tonywhitmore.co.uk/repos, and it's called Podcoder.
Regarding hosting, it's actually hosted on Ubuntu UK Loco server. The webpage is actually provided by the WordPress engine. We use various plugins, including Podpress. Regarding mirroring, we've actually, although it looks like a single file, that actually redirects to one of our mirrors, and that helps with load balancing. XML has had ISO clarification.
Oh, good.
Oh, good.
So that means it's now an officially ratified international standard, like open document format.
So there's now two standards.
Yeah.
Adobe have released Air for numerous platforms, including Linux.
Okay, what's Air?
It's a development environment and runtime environment for running applications coded in Flash, Flex, and something else.
So you can run proprietary programs on Linux?
Yeah.
Ooh. And Launchpad have announced that they now support OpenID for logins.
Yeah.
Does it work?
No.
Right.
The Conservative and Labour parties have both been arguing about who started talking about open source first, who got on the bandwagon first.
They're both wrong.
Surely it was the Green Party.
Yes. You know what? Who cares? Shout about it. The more the merrier. Let's talk about open source.
This week there was the Vulnerability Finding Contest, sponsored by Tipping Point, with the three main operating systems, and Ubuntu was the only one where vulnerability was not found.
Tick is now available for Ubuntu Live, the conference that's taking place at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland, Oregon, July 21st and 22nd.
UbuntuLive.com. So Dave, you're involved in the Mythbuntu project. What is it?
It's a home theatre PC project where basically it's a video recorder which is computer-based.
Okay, like a PVR?
Yes.
Personal video recorder?
Like a TiVo?
Sort of thing you can go and buy from the shops?
Yes.
So what's the difference between Mythbuntu and a PVR or a TiVo that I can go and buy in Woolworths?
Well, I think the difference is the feature set, the fact that you can customise it, the fact that you can easily upgrade it, and that you can connect it to your network, and you can watch it on another computer or something like that using, you know, actually drag and drop the files. And yeah, I don't think you can do that with a TiVo.
So I need a full computer to run this. and he's going to buy a new P4 or a Core 2 Duo.
Well, it's funny you say that, because there is actually one of the developers who's running on particularly old hardware. I think his back end, because it's split on a front and back end system. You can run it on the same computer, but it is split. One of the developers actually running it on, I think, on a 700 megahertz for his back end, and that's one which always stays on. There is a plug-in to make it so it switches on when it needs to, but most people tend to leave it on the whole time. And basically, that's a very low-powered computer, and all that does is that just does all the recording, and then you have a separate front-end which actually does the watching.
So what does it record?
Well, basically, if it's a Linux-supported tuner card, which most are these days...
So a digital TV card.
You can digital TV card, analog. Not so much in this country, but abroad they use cable, especially in America, you can use cable cards.
What about satellite?
Satellite, yes. I'm looking at getting FreeSat, actually, which is the new service being offered in Britain. There's also some functionality to be able to stream.
So what, like YouTube-type streaming? Or
Yeah, there is a plug-in for that. And not everyone's all that keen on it, because obviously the quality of videos on YouTube isn't necessary home cinema viewing.
And what can you do once you've recorded? So does it have like a graphical interface? They said there's a back end and a front end. The back end does recording.
Yeah. The back end does the recording, and that also presents a feature called MythWeb, and that's actually where you can administer the whole system, so you can set recordings, delete recordings, and even stream through that interface. So any computer that you've got an internet connection point, you can actually set programs to record from abroad and stream.
So if I'm at work and I hear on, you know, or I see on the web that there's a program on later and I'm not going to get home to record it, I could log on via the web to my machine at home and set it to record.
Yep, I've done that many times, yeah.
Multiple channels will it record? Obviously, depending on what you're trying to record, can I record multiple TV programs?
On the new version that's coming out, MythTV 0.21, that's actually got a multi-record option. And what that means is if you're running digital Freeview, you can record any channel which is given on that multiplex. Now, there's about six multiplexes, I think, and all the channels are transmitted on them. So basically, if you have two tuner cards, say, you could potentially record up to 10 channels simultaneously. The only limit is how much storage you've got and how fast you can write to the disk.
Excellent.
All right, because if I understand it, all the BBC channels, or most of the BBC channels, are in one multiplex. Yeah. So you could record BBC One, BBC Two, BBC Three and BBC Four at the same time with one tuner card.
Yeah, I think four might be on the separate one, but yeah, give us the same point. Yeah,
wow.
So you can record BBC One and BBC Two at the same time. The only problem is when BBC One, ITV and Channel 4 have interesting things at the same time.
And they're all on different multiplexes.
yeah.
Right. So you're going to need a lot of storage space for all this. It's quite a large file format, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you're looking at about a gigabyte an hour. So if you have a 100 gigabyte hard drive, you're looking at storing...
Yeah, but is that 1 gig an hour for one channel?
For one channel, yes. Right. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm quite, you know, I'm quite into it now. So I'm running... I've actually got 2 terabyte storage. And I haven't deleted any programs since January. So, but that's more than anyone needs. I mean, I started on a 200 gigabyte hard drive, I think, for my storage.
Can you not, like, squish them down a bit so that they take up less space?
Yeah, you can. Then you lose quality. But
well,
yeah.
No, but if quality wasn't your, you know, if you're watching it on a 14-inch TV in the bedroom, quality might not be your, yeah, you know, primary concern. Well, the disk space might be.
One of the options that MythTV actually has is user jobs. And that means that when a recording's finished, is you can set it to automatically or by option set tasks that happen. So you could compress and reduce to a compressed file format automatically. Or one thing that a lot of people do and is installed by default on the Ubuntu ones is commercial scanning. So it will actually automatically look for commercials in the recordings.
How well does it do that?
Reasonably well. It's particularly good on American programs. Because it looks for things like black splashes and difference in the screen picture, like the resolution, whether it's widescreen. You know, it looks for different things like that, maybe logos in the corner. I don't know the specifics of that, but it's reasonably good.
You say that you've got a remote, so it's a PC, so I don't have to sit there with a keyboard and a mouse in my living room.
Yeah.
It supports remote controls.
Yeah. I mean, most tuner cards these days actually come with remote controls, and that they are generally supported. You can also use other ones via there's a serial connection, there's a USB connection. So yeah, I mean you can get remotes. You can get remotes for less than £10 that come with the receiver.
Sorry, you said you got the back end, and is it you'd have the remote pointing to the front end?
Yeah,
Yeah. And the front end would be the thing that sits under your telly.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I like to try and not give the impression it's a computer. Like, I've got a slimline case, which is the same size as a DVD player, and you wouldn't know it's not a DVD player. And I like the fact that when people come around, they don't know I'm actually watching TV through a computer. I don't tell them, but I like the fact that I've just got a pretty interface.
What about the value-added features? As I understand it, it's not just TV and TV playback and recording. There are all sorts of other little plugins and things that you can add into it to extend the functionality.
Yeah, I mean, you get the base one where you just watch and record programmes, but you've also got another one called Myth DVD for watching DVDs, Myth Video for watching videos. There's a radio plugin which is under development. There's a crazy one called Myth Recipe, which is for displaying recipes.
Wow, who'd have thought it?
But yeah, there's quite a few plugins that are available.
Dave, tell me more about the DVD side. I don't watch the TV a lot, but I've got a lot of films. Can I convert my hundreds of DVDs, put them on the back end, and then have multiple PCs in the house play back any film?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can rip it into ISO format. And Myth TV will support playing back from the ISO.
That would be really big, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
like 4 to 9 gig per film or something.
Yeah, so I mean, if you want perfect quality, that's how you do it. But you can also, say, insert a DVD and say, I want to copy this. And you can compress it as well to what option you choose.
You said about multiple PCs around the house. So if I've got a back-end PC that's like medium to low spec and it's got the TV tuner cards in it, and that's running the Myth TV back-end, and then I have a front-end under the telly in my lounge, which looks like a DVD player, and I can use the menu and the remote control. That all sounds great. But you said you could have multiple front-ends, so yeah. I could have one in my bedroom?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the other day I was using my laptop as a front-end, which is a tablet, so I can fold the screen round. And using that wirelessly, with good signal, it works quite well.
So you don't have to wire up your whole house with Ethernet. You could use wireless?
Well, yes, although...
What's the limitation? Is it the speed that...
Yeah, I mean, if I've got bad signal, it will be juttering. I mean, I would recommend Ethernet or power over Ethernet.
Ethernet over power.
Yeah. Myth TV actually has two options. It's got an inbuilt streamer. It's got its own protocol. But it can also support reading from the file system. So if you've got an NFS or Samba share mounted to the front end, you can also make it so the front end will actually read that file directly rather than stream.
So if I've got a box with some files on, like one of those little NAS boxes you can buy that shares out disk space over Samba and NFS, I could use that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the new Myth TV that's coming out actually supports storage groups. So you could mount that as a storage location on the back end.
Right. There's another feature that you've mentioned to me in the past that sounded quite interesting, which was for my situation, when I'm at work, well, when I'm not at work, but in the evenings when I'm not at work, but working away from home, I'm staying in a place where I don't have a TV aerial. So I can't watch TV, but I have internet access. So I'm recording programs at home. Would it be easy for me to watch the programs that I've recorded at home from another location if I've got internet access?
Yeah, I mean, MythWeb, as I think I mentioned earlier on, it's actually got inbuilt streaming, which actually does uses Flash. It's not great quality. I would liken it to the BBC iPlayer for the quality. Well, it does go to full screen, but it's also quite dependent on your upstream bandwidth as well.
Oh, of course, yeah.
Sorry, is that Flash-generated playback in the new version?
Yes, yeah, the new one, which is 0.21, which is only released about a month ago, but it'll be in Hardy, and it's been backported to Gutsy.
All right, because when I've looked at the previous version, I think the version that's currently in Gutsy, it just allows you to download the whole video file in one big chunk.
Yeah.
Which obviously, because they're so large, can be a bit of a long process if you're miles away over a half a meg ADSL line or something.
But with the new version of Myth TV is standard in Hardy, and it's in the Gutsy backports repository as well, and upgrades have been safe.
What does Mythbuntu give us that taking normal Ubuntu and installing Myth TV on it via the packages doesn't give us?
Well, I think the major thing is the quickness of setup. I mean, as I understand it, you're currently running Myth TV and Ubuntu.
I installed Myth TV on Ubuntu Edgy when that was current, so 18 months ago.
Yeah.
And that was fine. It supported the hardware, and it was a case of working through the setup routine, which was okay to do, but I know I'm a technical user. I was able to do it. And it's been upgraded since then.
But I'm still guessing that it took you at least a couple of hours to set up.
Yeah, one or two.
A couple of weeks, wasn't it, Tony?
Well, in some respects, it took 2 years. I started buying the hardware a couple of years before I finally got to a point where I was saying, this is ready and this works.
I must say, Tony, I've been to your house a few times since then, and I've never seen it running.
Well, it runs all the time, and it records. In all honesty, it's the only thing we've used for recording TV and watching TV for the last 18 months or so. It took a long time for kind of get the hardware and for all the bits of drivers and things to make their way into the kernel. But once I had my hand on an Ubuntu Edgy CD, it took, I don't know, 4-6 hours from going from bare metal hardware to having it all set up and running and MythWeb and all the bits and bobs working. Now, 6 hours is not an insignificant amount of time, but compared with the previous revisions, which were running on Debian and you had to SSH in and export environment variables and use complex Xen command lines to watch any TV, it's somewhat more user-friendly just to have a remote.
So if you used the Ubuntu desktop of Edgy to install that?
I used the alternate CD because I wanted to be able to... I didn't want to have to run a full desktop environment on my relatively low-power small form factor box. So it literally has the alternate CD installed command line with no desktop. And just X, no desktop environment on top of that. X automatically starts, and that automatically starts the front end. And if the front end crashes for some reason, it will automatically restart the front end. So we've got over the phone call saying, I can't watch any TV because your rubbish box is broken. And there's a big green button on the remote control, which is linked to kill -9 myth front end. So if for some reason the playback locks up and you get a hardware funk, whack the button, it'll restart the front end, which happens very, very occasionally. The least stable module seems to be Myth Music.
So you mean you've actually partly answered it there. The fact that you had to use the alternate CD or have used the desktop CD for a live CD installation, you would have a bloated desktop. I mean, you would have OpenOffice on a TV.
Mm.
So I think that's one of the major things Mythbuntu actually offers is the fact that you can insert the CD, and you know within an hour you're gonna be watching channels. I think the other thing is that you can actually use the CD as a front end from the live environment, which is quite a nice.
What feature. Without installing? So if I've got a spare PC and I just want to try out the front end, I can whack the CD in. And...
But I still think you should probably treat it as the same as you would with the Ubuntu desktop live.
Yeah, just trying it out.
Yeah, I mean you wouldn't want that for production use.
Could you run it off like a USB key on a small form factor diskless?
You've raised a good point there. Our actual new feature, our new feature actually supports that. It's Ubuntu diskless, Mythbuntu diskless. You can either, it's got two options. You can either use it from the USB key, but the real thing is actually booting PXE, which is basically diskless, and it gets its whole image from the back end, and that's very fast and very efficient, and that's where I think the future is going.
And that way you can have something that's literally no fans, no moving parts in your front end, very low current draw, and you can have as many of them around the house as you want, really, and just add another one is trivial, it could fire up. That would be really quite cool.
I mean, the only problem is some of the smaller ones don't actually support PXE, and that's why you have to use the USB as a boot device.
Right.
Is it an official Ubuntu project, or is it something that's done by a few people in their spare time or something?
Well, we're just over a year old, and within a couple of months, we approached the Community Council for blessing, and they granted it without any problems. So, yes, I mean, we're an official Ubuntu project, but we're not supported by Canonical. So.
And your packages are in the standard Ubuntu repositories?
Well, that was one of our founding things. It was that everything we do, we push back to the normal Ubuntu repositories. So you can get Mythbuntu functionality from the normal Ubuntu repository.
I think I saw a how-to that said you could take a standard Ubuntu desktop and then, you know, just add a bunch of packages that are in the repository and off you go. You've got MythTV. And obviously, from your point of view, that's not how you want people to do it. You would want people to use Mythbuntu because that's how you tailor the application, I guess. It doesn't matter.
If they're using MythTV, they can use whatever desktop they want. We actually ship the XFCE one, which is the same one as Ubuntu has. But if they install the Mythbuntu desktop package, which is, you know, designed in the same way as Ubuntu desktop, Kubuntu desktop, then they will actually be provided with the same functionality. It would look as though they did actually install from Mythbuntu.
Cool. Does it tie in with the releases of Ubuntu?
Yep, we've currently got a beta out, which is undergoing testing. And, so we should be pretty much following in the same release schedule as Ubuntu and probably about the same time as Kubuntu comes out.
Cool.
And you can find further information at mythbuntu.org.
We had a few emails this week, one from Paul O'Malley asking us if we ever thought of doing audio tutorials with a web page of commands to give the extra layer of polish. I think what he's suggesting here is that we have some kind of tech talk teaching people how to do stuff within the podcast. What do you guys think about that?
It's an interesting suggestion. Audio is probably not the best way of giving over complex commands, hence the document accompanying it. It would take a lot of work to polish and get right.
And is it worth doing given there are other resources like the wiki and documentation and stuff?
The Ubuntu Wiki is one of the major plus points of the community. There's so much stuff already documented on there. I worry about creating a second version of that almost if we were to be hugely successful at it.
And we'd also become out of date and not editable.
Yeah, and it would mean a lot of work. It's quite a lot of work just putting the podcast together, never mind writing tutorials as well. Having said that, maybe there are members of the community who are interested in contributing tutorials.
So what do you think, Dave?
I think that might be a suggestion, but I don't know. Audience, let us know what you want.
Emails to podcast@ubuntu-uk.org.
We had an email from Michael G. Fletcher on our segment about Would You Go Back? And he says that one of the things that has helped him not have to go back is using virtualization. He uses VirtualBox from virtualbox.org, and it's also packaged in Ubuntu, to give him a Windows installation. So for the very few Windows applications he still needs, he can run it in unified mode, which makes it appear as if it's a native Linux app on his desktop.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Having Windows applications on top of your GNOME or KDE desktop, it's quite nice having it all seamlessly integrated together. Works quite well.
Yeah, so the example Simon was saying about having to install Windows so that your wife could do ACDL.
Yeah.
So one of the things that Michael suggested is you could just run it inside VirtualBox in unified mode, yeah, still get access to Office and not have to install the Windows OS.
Good idea. Thanks for that.
There's a great tutorial actually on the Ubuntu Wiki. If you go to wiki.ubuntu.com/virtualbox, a tutorial on how to get that working.
Okay, he also suggests that we might want to talk more about virtualization in future episodes because it's quite a big subject, and we might just do that.
Right, so episode 3 in the can.
Yep, nice one. I'm off to Lug Radio Live in the USA. If you're going over there, come along and say hello. I'll be working the video crew, so I'll probably have a video camera on me. And also, the next episode might be a couple of days late as a result, because I'm flying back and we're going to have to delay the recording by a day or so.
Slacker. Canonical have given us approval to use the Ubuntu trademark in our podcast, which is good news.
Yep, so you can keep track of what we're up to on our Twitter feed, which is twitter.com/UUPC.
You can email us at podcast@ubuntu-uk.org if you've got any suggestions for the show, or if you've recorded any material or tips or anything for us, just please email us.
Join us on IRC on the Freenode network at #ubuntu-uk.
Okay, we'll see you next time. Bye
bye.
See ya.
Bye.